Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Hope you're all having a great day wherever you are. I am your host, Jeff Nadeau. We are back for another week, another sit down, another great episode planned today. And it's a great time of the year. If you know about me, and I'm a big sports bettor, we've got March Madness. It's March. And, you know, March brings a lot of basketball, a lot of hopefully money and more. And we're getting closer to the spring and summer months. This is always great. You know, you get through the long months of winter, and you know, spring is getting closer to springing. So excited about that. We get another great episode planned today. Thanks as always for listening. Blackjack Fletcher is just a little under the weather, so I'm going to take on this episode on my own. I want to thank everybody for the kind words about last week's episode. We did an interview with the very interesting Joaquin Jack Garcia, former FBI agent who infiltrated the Gambino crime family and did other really interesting organized crime work as far as infiltrations, and got a lot of great feedback on that. If you haven't checked it out, please go check it out for sure. We're going to get back to the biographies today, and we got a big one. We're going to talk about one of the real egomaniacs in the history of the mafia, a name that many of you know, a name that is synonymous with really the early days of the mafia. We're going to talk about Vito Genovese, the namesake of the Genovese crime family, and we're going to go over his life, a life filled with really the typical start for a mobster, but it would really careen out of control. And a lot of it would end in the fact that Vito was just an egomaniac and he wanted power by any means necessary. He'd ultimately get it, but it would come at a large price. As always, make sure you check us out on Twitter at the Sitdown 7. And if you want more great mob content, make sure you go check us out on YouTube. YouTube is really had been fun as well. We obviously have the weekly show on you know, the show you're listening to now, but I try to throw up some smaller videos on some smaller gangsters. I think you might enjoy it if it's mob content you're looking for. So make sure you go check us out on YouTube as well. Just search The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. All right, everybody, as you know, we don't do much in the way of preambles around here. Let's get right to the biography. Vito Genovese on the sit down. Vito Genovese was born November 21st, 1897 in Tufino, which is in Italy. It is just outside of Naples, a very small little town, really to the northwest of Naples, about 30 miles away. It's not far from the town of Avellino, if you've ever heard of Avellino. You know, really just right a stone's throw away from Napoli. So, you know, Vito Genovese really would spend his formative years in Italy. He was one of four children to his father, Francis, and his mother, Nunziata. He would have a sister and two brothers. And really, not a lot's known about Vito Genovese's life in Italy. It wouldn't be until the age of 15 that his family would actually emigrate to the United States. In 1913, the Genovese family would take the SS Taormina and they would come to New York City. They would settle in Greenwich Village, basically in the Little Italy area that we know of today. Vito Genovese would really start out his career like many other young hoodlums and mobsters. He would really just, you know, petty crimes, stealing stuff from vendors, running errands for mobsters, and collecting money for what we know as the lottery. And obviously in places like Harlem, Little Italy, the Italian sections of New York, just like any other ethnic group, they had their own lottery. And Vito Genovese was very big into kind of being the collector a lot of the time for these illegal lotteries. It wouldn't be until 19 that Vito Genovese would actually take his first pinch. He would be arrested for possessing a firearm in 1917. And he'd actually be arrested and would go to prison. Back in those times, there was a place called Blackwell's Island. Think of it like Rikers Island before Rikers Island. And there's a very famous piece of an island actually in New York City. And back then they had these mental hospitals and actually a prison on this island. It had been an inhabited island that was on the East River. And it really was the place before we had our modern day Rikers. And now, if you know anything about Rikers, they're looking to actually close that. But Vito Genovese would actually spend some time there in the late 1910s. He would eventually get out and he did right back to the streets. And by the 1920s, he would start meeting up with other local hoodlums, including Lucky Luciano, Frank Costello, and other young hoods in the area. Obviously, around this time, bootlegging was becoming a major thing. And a lot of these young mobsters were working for an individual called Joe the Boss Masseria. We've talked about Joe the Boss. He would be one of the early purveyors of organized crime in America. And he would, at one point, be the boss of really the Lucky Luciano crime family. He obviously, as we know, we'll get into what would happen to him and his main rival, Salvatore Maranzano. We've talked about that before on the show. He would originally become part of what was known as the Morello crime family. But a lot of these young mobsters would really start out working under people like Joe the Boss. And they, in turn, would also work for an individual called Arnold Rothstein. We've talked about Arnold the Brain. He was kind of the bank for all these young guys. He would basically show them that bootlegging could be a legitimate, very well-run business. You could actually get really rich as a bootlegger. And a lot of players like Luck Luciano, Frank Costello, and Vito Genovese would kind of, get their start getting financing from Arnold, and he would put them in business, and he would make them all very rich men. And he would also, in the process, teach them basically how to make a lot of money, because there were very few people that were making more money than Arnold Rothstein. Arnold was an accomplished gambler. He was someone that obviously had business outside of bootlegging. He had enormous wealth. He was truly one of the largest bootleggers in all of America. And if you've ever seen a Boardwalk Empire, there was a terrific portrayal of him by a guy called Michael Stuhlbarg. He really acted out, I thought, Arnold Rothstein, from what I know, like a great actor does. But so Genovese kind of got that start in that Luciano group. And, Vito would actually also establish what was known as the Greenwich Village crew. And he would actually establish a really powerful group of guys around him. And many of them would ultimately have a very long career in the mob themselves, including a guy called Tony Bender Strollo. Tony was a longtime member. He'd actually be killed many years later by Vito's people. But Tony Bender would be a large part of what the Greenwich Village crew was early in its heyday. It's important that obviously when you have, you want to come up and be a mobster, it's important that you come up and have good people around you. And that's something that the Greenwich Village crew and Vito Genovese surely had. They also had other good hoodlums around as well, including a guy called Tommy Ryan Aboli. Tommy Ryan would be kind of the enforcer. He would be part of a wheel man. He was an ex-boxer, and he'd actually ultimately would train a lot of kids. A lot of people know that he would actually ultimately train Vincent Gigante when he would become a boxer many years later. They also had a guy called Mike Miranda, who was a gun runner, an enforcer, a hitman, and a drug dealer. These were all real powerful guys and all guys that really had their own role in the Greenwich Village crew. So slowly but surely, Vito Genovese is building up a nice group of people around him. He would also develop another great ability, and that was being a hitman. He would be realized pretty quick by someone like Joe the Boss Masseria that if you needed killing, Vito Genovese was the guy to do it for you. And one of the people that he's called on to kill in really the late 20s, early 30s, was a guy called Gaetano Reina. Reina was a guy that worked out of the Bronx. He was obviously in direct, he was around the Masseria stuff, and they would all kind of split off to form their own families, including Masseria, who kind of broke away from the Morellos. Reina he moved along to kind of create his own family, which would ultimately become, the Lucchese crime family many years later. But ultimately, he would be killed. And the individual that would take him out was Vito Genovese. So on the evening of February 26, 1930, Rainier would actually leave his mistress's home in the Bronx. That's where he kind of did his business when he was ambushed. Now, many people believe that it was Vito Genovese that took care of him. They would shoot him in the head with a double-barreled shotgun, instantly killing him. They would find a handgun and money on him. So it was clear that it was not a robbery. It was really just a beef that had to be taken care of. And this one would lead kind of to the war between Masseria and Maranzano, which I'm not going to go in deep to because we've talked about that time and time again. And this would really be where the mob takes its modern day move. Lucky Luciano basically says, I'm sick and tired of these mustache Petes like Maranzano and Masseria. And he would systematically eliminate both of them, starting with Joe the Boss Masseria, who would be killed in April 1931. We don't need to go into a diatribe of how he was killed. We've talked about that before. In September of 1931, he would finish off the job and take care of Salvatore Maranzano. Now, during all this, Vito Genovese is slowly building a reputation in the Genovese crime family. Now, the problem that Vito realized quickly was there was some resentment building with him and the other people that were in the Genovese crime family or the modern day Luciano family. People like Frank Costello, who, you know, these guys had all known each other for really a long time, but I think there was always a resentment with Vito and these other guys, including Lucky Luciano. He obviously knew that Lucky was the more powerful one, but he also didn't like the fact that Lucky Luciano very much wanted to do business with Jewish people. He had that old school thought that, I don't want to do business with Jews, Vito felt like. And, you know, Lucky was smart enough to realize that I don't really care. They're all friends to me and they're all people that can put money in my, you know, my pocket and money in your pocket. So why are we worried about it? He also had developed kind of a beef with Frank Costello. Now, some of the beef, a lot of people believe may have been kind of legend, but legend would have it that Frank Costello would always call Vito Genovese Don Vitone, which was kind of, he felt like a slight to him because he wasn't really the boss, but he had this like power trip and needed to be boss. So Frank Costello would fuck around with him and call him Don Vitone. And there would also be a meeting that would ultimately be set up where Vito Genovese would bring to the table as to why are we doing business with Jewish people. Quote, what the hell is this? What are you trying to do? Load us up with a bunch of Hebes? Question mark. Before Benny or Meyer could even open their mouths, Frank Costello would almost swing at Vito Genovese and would say very kindly, take it easy, Don Vitone. You're nothing but a fucking foreigner yourself. Now that would come directly from the last testament of Lucky Luciano. So it kind of displayed the resentment that, you know, Vito Genovese was a power-hungry egomaniac, and he kind of realized that all these people were going to be kind of, you know, issues for him because he ultimately wanted to be in front of them and be kind of the boss of all them. And he knew that, you know, he was a sensitive guy. It was pretty clear. But that would be something that he would obviously kind of deal with for a long time. In 1931, he would get some bad news, though I don't know if it was that bad for him. In 1931, his first wife would actually pass away. But by this point, Vito Genovese had actually already took it up with another woman, a woman called Anna Petillo. The problem for Vito Genovese was Anna Petillo was married. She was married to a guy called Gerard Vernotico. And, you know, as the power-hungry egomaniac Vito Genovese is, he decides, well, fuck this guy. I want his wife. So I'm just going to kill her. In 1932, Gerald Vernotacchio was killed and found strangled on a rooftop. So this is the kind of guy Vito Genovese was. He's slowly making his presence felt in the street, but he was also saying, you know what? I don't give a fuck. If it's going to lead to murder, if I want something, I'm going to get it. And I'm going to take out, people that I don't like. He would ultimately marry Anna Petillo, and they would move to 124 Thompson Street. And ultimately, then he would move her to Fifth Avenue in a nice brand new digs on the trendy, posh, famous street. As we know, in the mid-30s, 35, around that time, Thomas Dewey is turning up the heat on the mob. Prohibition is over, and he's kind of going after people like Lucky Luciano and other mobsters. The thought from up top was, we have to get rid of public enemy number one, the mafia in this country. So he obviously brings a case against Lucky Luciano, that big prostitution case, with little Davey Battillo. And the problem is, Lucky goes away. And this would be the first kind of time that he would ultimately kind of have to relinquish power. Vito Genovese would become the acting boss of the Luciano crime family. So Vito finally gets his wish, and Lucky goes away. And ultimately, he really never comes back because he ends up getting deported, as we know. But we'll get to that in just a second. The problem, though, that Vito Genovese has is his time on top doesn't necessarily last very long. He would be jammed up after an informant called Ernest Ruppolo goes to the feds and tells them that he was told by Vito Genovese to kill a guy, Ferdinand Butcha. Butcha was this, you know, kind of lower level mobster that had conspired with Vito Genovese to cheat this real wealthy guy out of a card game. And after the game, obviously, Butcha, who's in partners with Genovese, decides, well, look, I want my money. Where am I going to get my money? Kind of like Maury in Goodfellas when Jimmy Burke wouldn't give him the money. So instead of giving him the money like Jimmy Burke doesn't, he just kills Maury. Well, that's exactly what Genovese does. He kills, has Butcha killed. And according to the FBI, this Ruppolo guy is the guy that allegedly did it. So Vito Genovese has a major problem. He decides, fuck this, in 1936, you know, even though I became a citizen, I'm out. He would flee to Italy with a ton of cash and settle in a city called Nola, which is right near Tufino, where he's from. And this would kind of domino effect down to Frank Costello, and he would become acting boss. The good thing for Vito Genovese was he would take up shop in Italy and kind of become, you know, chummy with a lot of important people. He would befriend an individual called Galeazzo Ciano. Ciano was the son-in-law of Benito Mussolini. And Mussolini, as we know, was the king of the fascist party, and he was becoming a very powerful political figure. So what does Genovese do? He starts lathering his campaign coffers with money. And he was becoming a chummy pal of Benito Mussolini. And this would ultimately lead down the road to something that we talked about during the Carmine Galanti show about that guy, Carlo Tresca, which we'll get into here in kind of just a second. But Genovese was slowly pandering to people like Mussolini, who was kind of a weird connection just because of kind of who Mussolini was. And ultimately, he would kind of abandon Mussolini at one point. But I want to get into 1943, right, really before the war. This guy, Carlo Tresca, is making waves. Tresca was a guy that owned a newspaper that was anti-fascist. You know, he would be your modern day political prisoner, if you will. He decides to start writing these like really slanderous articles about Mussolini. And due to his connection with Vito Genovese, Mussolini says, I'm fucking tired of this guy. This Il Martello newspaper is out of control. He goes to Genovese and says, hey, can you take care of this fucking guy? So he would call on, Vito Genovese would call on what many people believe is Carmine Galanti, who through Joe Bonanno, they would kind of figure that all out. Tresca is walking out of the newspaper office one night. Two people pull up and Galanti allegedly gets out of the car and kills him right on the street. Now, a lot of people would believe that the driver that night was a guy called Joe Beck di Palermo. Now, Joe Beck was a big-time heroin pusher in the Lucchese crime family. And as we know, Carmine Galanti was a very big drug dealer as well. And Vito Genovese at one point was a big drug dealer too. So they all were connected to each other. And we'll actually talk a little bit more about Joe Beck Di Palermo a little bit later in the show. But this is the kind of things that Genovese was doing. He obviously is in exile in Italy, but he's making the right connections with people like Mussolini. But by 1945, it would all kind of come and fall down for Vito Genovese. He would kind of quickly decide, you know what, I'm going to, by this point, I'm going to switch sides and offer my services to the army, which, as we know, a lot of mobsters did. We know Lucky Luciano was very integral to certain things. He became kind of a helpful hand to the Americans. It seemed like everyone was willing to forgive these mob guys as long as they were able to produce certain things for the Allied forces. It wouldn't matter, though. Eventually, Genovese is implicated. He's the guy that's supposed to be killed, this Butcher guy, and the FBI and the feds bring him in. He would ultimately plead not guilty to the 1934 murder of Ferdinand Butcher. The good thing for Genovese, though, is he knows that, like usual, he can just eliminate the competition, just like he did with his wife's ex-husband many years before. Vito Genovese believed that, you know, as long as they're not here, they can't testify. It's very easy to kill people, so I'll just do them. So what happens is all these people start turning up dead that are directly involved with the Butcher case. And in 1946, the case was dismissed. No one was willing to corroborate Ernie Ruppolo's testimony. At one point, Judge Samuel Leibowitz would comment to Vito Genovese, quote, "I cannot speak for the jury, but I believe if there were even a shred of corroborating evidence, you would have been condemned to the electric chair." So as we know about the United States justice system, you may be guilty, but it's the government's burden of proof to prove that you did it. And sometimes a killer is going to go walk free. Now, ultimately, for members of the mob, we almost would tell them that it was a shame that it didn't actually work out, because Vito Genovese would just be kind of getting started with his behavior. Now, weirdly enough, just to kind of put a bow on Ernest Ruppolo, who ended up being a rat, he wouldn't be killed many years later, many people believe, by Sonny Franzese. That actually is something that supposedly Franzese did as a favor. That would happen in 1964. But by that point in 1964, Vito Genovese was obviously in prison, but just kind of an interesting tip on that. So Vito Genovese was smart enough to realize that as long as I eliminate my competition, I don't have to worry. But now my goal, now that I'm a free man, is I want to go back and establish control of, you know, the power, the tip top position. The thing was, by this point, Lucky Luciano is back in control, and he's through Cuba organizing a meeting to kind of figure some things out. There was a lot of things going on at this time in the mid-40s, right after World War II. Obviously, they had to get the drug situation figured out. Heroin was big business. They wanted to figure out what was going on and what the future of Cuba, what that was going to be. And they had to deal with Las Vegas, because Bugsy Siegel was really fucking dragging his feet on taking care of the Flamingo Hotel. So Lucky found out that Cuba was a really inviting place, and we'll go down to Havana and we'll have our little conference. And we've talked about this. We talked about it during the Lucky Luciano episode. You know, as I've said before, Vito Genovese was always very resentful of, obviously, Lucky, and I think of Frank Costello, because he was so different than those guys. Now, obviously, those guys could be violent if they needed to be, but they were more money men. They were more, distinguished. They were more regal. They were doing it, you know, almost a little bit easier than Vito was doing. Vito had to do it from the muscle. He had to kill people. He had to be out in the streets. And I feel like he resented those guys a little bit. And that's exactly when Lucky Luciano kind of said, you know, "Vito, fall the fuck back, basically. I'm in charge. You know, don't try to fucking stomp on my toes again, or I'm going to lose my temper," basically. So, you know, Vito kind of puts his tail between his legs and goes back to being the Capo regime and the Greenwich Village crew. That wouldn't stop Vito Genovese from his continued obsession with power, but he would obviously have to deal with some things of his own. He would obviously have to testify, as many did, or not him, but people would have to testify in front of the Kefauver hearings. One of them would be a guy called Willie Moretti, who Vito would ultimately have killed and assassinated. Interestingly enough, Willie Moretti was pretty powerful guy. He'd be the cousin of Frank Costello. He was the underboss of the Genovese crime family. Vito Genovese decides that he's got to start kind of killing off people systematically, not to set off any alarms, but to systematically do it. He knew that Lucky Luciano was deported and there's nothing he could really do about it. So, eventually, if I just bide my time, I can just kill everybody off. The problem that he had to deal with in the early 50s, though, was from his former wife, Anna. In 1952, she would actually sue him for financial support and then ultimately divorce him. And she was pretty much saying, look, you're making all this money being a big mafia chieftain, and I'm not making anything out of it. He would countersue her for desertion. She was asking the judge for a certain amount of money, and Anna Genovese would ultimately kind of, in a way, dry snitch to the feds that he was the ruler of the lottery and he had all this money and all these businesses and legit stuff and all this stuff. And why wasn't she getting anything out of it? So his own wife was kind of deserting him, if you will. She was sick and tired of his nonsense. And, he was a nut. I mean, everybody knows that. He was an egomaniac nut job. And then he would start like killing people that he thought she was having affairs with. And it was just getting really touchy, really, really touchy. And that was the big thing about Vito Genovese. He was an egomaniac who loved power and he would kill anyone. He would walk over anybody for that success. He would obviously take out Willie Moretti. Many people believe he ultimately would have an individual called Joe Adonis deported. And that was something that, he would always be also very famous for. There was a lot of backroom things going on where, people would get arrested or be deported. Joe Adonis was a powerful capo. He was a guy aligned with, the people that Vito wanted to get out of the way. So he knew that if he did stuff like deporting him, he would kind of hamstring him like he did Lucky Luciano. And this would, obviously lead to one of the last people he would have to deal with before he could really, truly take control. And that was that old fuck Frank Costello, who, would make fun of him for years, kind of, was that thing that I think Vito maybe knew he would never be, but didn't even really like. I feel like he looked at Frank Costello as kind of that that snotty, uppity guy, right? Frank was this regal guy who loved to get, go to the spa and hang in his garden and ride horses. That was the kind of thing that Frank Costello was. He knew that he had to take Frank Costello out. So what would he do? He would go to his young protege, an individual called Vincent Gigante, who had really come up in the same streets that he did, which was trained in boxing by his former partner, Tommy Rinaboli. And he sets up a situation where he's going to kill Frank Costello. So he goes to his old friend, Vincent Gigante, and says, look, I need to systematically take out Frank Costello. I want you to do it, Gigante. So on May 2nd, 1957, as we know, Costello's walking into Central Park West, and Frank comes in. Gigante comes out of the shadows. This is for you, Frank. Shoots him, and I guess believes that he kills him and runs out. Problem was, Costello was just wounded. We know what happens. He ends up not implicating Gigante, and Costello decides, you know what? I've had enough. I'm pretty old anyway. I'm going to just retire. So this is starting to really work out for Vito Genovese. He systematically eliminated, for the most part, Lucky Luciano, Willie Moretti, by killing him. Joe Adonis is deported. Frank Costello is retired. And the last piece of business he needs to deal with is Albert Anastasia, who was a staunch Lucky and Frank loyalist. And at any rate, he knew that this would allow him to become capo di tutti capi, which is boss of all bosses, because his friend Carlo Gambino could take over and he would truly be the boss. He would be the guy. He could switch it from the Luciano family to the Genovese crime family. Very simple. So eventually, as we know, we don't need to go into a diatribe about Albert Anastasia. In 1957, he would be murdered in the barbershop of the Park Sheraton Hotel. Now, a lot of people ask me on a regular basis, who were the shooters in that case? I've said many times, okay, it is not Joey Gallo and Carmine Persico. They did not match the description. They did not match the age. They did not really match anything that the witnesses that saw the shooters testified to. I've always believed that it had a lot to do with Joe Biondo of the Gambino family. He put it all in motion. And I am led to believe that it was kind of a group of guys, whether it was Stephen Grimalta or Stephen Armone. There were some Jewish guys involved. I'll just say this. I do not believe the killer of Albert Anastasia's were Joey Gallo and Carmen Persico. I just don't. So back to Vito Genovese. It was finally his family. Okay, he could really, he knew that Lucky was really the only one left, but Lucky was so far away that it really wouldn't matter. And he would hold this big meeting, just like his predecessor Luciano did way back in 1946 in Havana. By 1957, after the murder, it was time to bring everybody back in and say, you know what, folks? I'm the top man now. And you have to say about Vito Genovese, like, he wanted something and he went out and took it. And he was willing. And that's one thing that I know, that when you look at a boss, you have to say to yourself, you have to be ruthless. You have to be an egomaniac a bit. You have to crave power so much that you're willing to get rid of everyone in front of him. I guess we have to ask ourselves, was he an egomaniac? Sure he was. But was he a stone cold fucking gangster? 10,000%. Vito Genovese knew that to gain the power that he needed, he had to eliminate everybody in front of him. And he pretty much did that. Now, the new thought was, okay, now that I've eliminated everyone and I'm in charge now, I'm going to change the namesake to the Genovese crime family, and I'm going to have a big party to celebrate it. So he would go to several other contemporaries, including Russell Bufalino, who was in charge of Northeastern Pennsylvania. We actually did a show on him and other members of the Buffalo and Northeastern mobs. And he would say, look, we need a big conference. Let's have it at Joe Barber's house, who had an estate up in Apalachin, New York. So on November 14th, 1957, he would call on all the different bosses around the country to come in and break bread. There would be tons of food, and it would be fairly inconspicuous. The problem was, it was a little town in New York, and most of the New York State troopers became suspicious. Now, I've always believed that, I don't think this is just a random, like, oh, we just happened to see a ton of cars, so we started looking into it. I have some weird suspicion that Lucky Luciano was somehow behind this little stunt to kind of jump in and you know, hurt the whole little party. Now, ultimately, a lot of mobsters would be brought in and arrested. And this would be a big embarrassment, because what this did was, it really kind of put the mob in the late 50s as, this is what it is. These guys in fedora hats and suits and big cars all meeting together, this shady criminal syndicate. This was a big problem. And it was all because of Vito Genovese's obsession with having to show that he was the big boss, the capo di tutti capi. Why be a gangster if no one knows who you are, right? The whole thing, though, it wouldn't last long, his, you know, power. And a lot of people would kind of go back on this and say, like, is this systematic, just like doing what you have to do to eliminate people? Is this a rat move? But 6 months later, quote, anonymous source would reveal that they would basically have information to implicate Vito Genovese in a drug deal. So what happened was a guy, a Puerto Rican drug dealer called Nelson Canelops, would claim that he met with Genovese in 1957, and was wanting to sell him heroin. Now, it also, when you look at it, it doesn't make a ton of sense. Like, why would a major boss, in fact, the biggest boss in the country at that time, involve himself with anything like that, especially like drugs? Like, it just didn't really make a lot of sense. But, you know, obviously the government's not going to try to argue with it. They're just going to pin it on Genovese and put him away. A lot of people, you know, obviously allegedly believe that Lucky Luciano was the one that paid this Puerto Rican guy $100,000 to do this. It was a back and forth. Luciano would do it, then Genovese would do it, and then ultimately Luciano would get the last laugh, because in 1959, Genovese would be convicted in New York of a conspiracy to violate federal narcotics laws and would ultimately get 15 years in prison. Now, in Five Families, the great book by Selwyn Robb, I urge you, if you're a mob fan, you got to go out and get that. He would say that, you know, many people have questioned the legitimacy of this. And the police would also discuss that. A guy called Ralph Salerno would say that anyone who understands the protocol and installation procedures in the mafia would find it almost unbelievable that a crime boss would be directly involved in a drug operation. And it's true. I mean, there's no real reason to believe why at this point he's literally the boss of the biggest brigada in America. Why the fuck would he be selling drugs with some, you know, Puerto Rican, you know, corner boy? You know, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. But it would put Vito Genovese away. And he would go with several other people, and they would go to prison. Included in prison was one of Vito Genovese's people, a guy called Joe Valachi. He was a gangster in the Genovese crime family. And he was, you know, obviously from Harlem, and he was violent in his own right. He kind of came up in the same time that Vito Genovese did. And he would eventually have to serve a sentence for heroin in the box with Vito Genovese. Now, this would become a big problem for Vito Genovese, because he believes at one point in the early 60s that Joe Valachi is a rat. So he orders that guy, Joe Becky Palermo, who was also in prison at the time, to take care of Genovese, or to take care of Valachi on behalf of Genovese. He would give him the contract and say, take him out. Valachi finds out that Vito wants him dead, and he knows that it's Joe Beck that's going to do it. The problem is he mistakes another inmate for Joe Beck, and in 1962 uses a steel pipe and beats him to death. So he gets wind that he's going to be killed and ends up beating up some guy who he thinks Joe Beck D. Palermo, and it's not. At that point, he's hit with a murder charge and facing life in prison. Now, Joe Valachi would venture to believe and try to tell people that, you know, he just decided that he hated the mafia and he wanted to get out from under his issue. Ultimately, though, he had a fucking murder beef and wanted to get out from under it. So he starts spilling his guts on everything mafia. The feds would whisk him away from prison. And in 1963, Joe Valachi would testify before McClellan's permanent subcommittee on investigations of the United States Senate committee. And he would talk and say that the Italian-American mafia obviously exists. We don't have to go into his stuff, but he would really be the first person to break the oath of what we know of as Omerta. And this would really be the first big, you know, problem for the mob. Everyone now knew that it was a thing. And someone like Joe Valachi took it out. And if we look back on all this, really the issue for this was, you know, Vito Genovese decides that, you know, he's going to kill Joe Valachi. Valachi ends up killing a random guy and then gets a murder beef and decides, you know what, fuck this. I'm not doing life for a guy that wants to have me killed anyway. So I'm going to flip. You have to obviously give Valachi, I guess, credit, because it's like, I wouldn't do time for that shithead either. I mean, he wanted to have me killed. In fact, he wanted me killed. I knew he did. Now, I'm not making an excuse for Joe Valachi, but he would ultimately do what he had to do, and he would shed a lot of light on what the mob was. Originally, Vito Genovese got 15 years in prison, but this would obviously be a big problem for him. It wouldn't last long, though. In 1969, Vito Genovese would actually pass away at the USP Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri, after he had a heart attack. That happened on February 14th, 1969. He's buried in Middle Village, Queens. Interestingly enough, Joe Valachi wouldn't last too long after that. He would actually have a heart attack as well in 1971 as he served out a sentence in Latuna in Texas. And, you know, they really pretty much died from the same thing, both a heart attack. I guess all that stress ultimately did Joe Valachi in. So, you know, when you look back on Vito Genovese, you look at kind of the thought of what he was able to do to get to become the boss. And then he ultimately really wasn't the boss very long. Look at all the shit he did. And he spent his last couple of years in prison. He never really truly got to enjoy the boss title. Now, I guess the thing for him that ended up working out is, you know, this whole time, the family's been known as the Genovese crime family. And I'm sure in wherever Vito Genovese is, he's enjoying the fact that his namesake has continued to live on. He was a gangster through and through. He was an egomaniac. I don't ever knock him kind of like I've done others, just like Carmine Glanty and some of these other lunatics who were just stupid. He was a stone cold fucking gangster, but he was an egomaniac that just, you know, ultimately did too much. And he went away like any gangster would. You kind of look at it like, you know, when you court a woman, right? You court her for so long, you want her for so long, then you eventually get her and it's not what you thought it would be. And it ends up falling apart. It's kind of what happened to Vito Genovese in the end. So we'll look back on him. And obviously, like many of his predecessors, he took what he wanted by any means necessary. Interestingly enough, when we look at the kind of the long-term from the Genovese, let's look at the quickly before we end. Let's look at the Genovese crime family really from its inception, way back when it was the Morello crime family, right? You know, Masseria takes over, you know, he, you know, isn't boss for too long, 7-8 years. Lucky takes over. He's boss for a really long time. You have a couple acting bosses between Genovese and Costello. You know, Genovese is the boss for, you know, on the street, 2 years. He ends up boss until 69 when he dies. We know most of his day-to-day shit was not really being done by him. It was a couple of, you know, people on the street, Benny the Squint, people like that. You know, then once he dies, Genovese dies, Benny the Squint was obviously successful for about 12 years. He dies in, or he retires in 81 and then dies. Vincent Gigante takes over. Tony Salerno's very much involved. He was a powerhouse. And then you look at kind of the current leadership that we see today. You look back at since Giuseppe Morello in the late 1800s up until the current leadership, the one fucking lunatic egomaniac was Vito Genovese, the only really bad leader they had. And he was only the boss really on the street for 2 years. But him dying was pretty much a godsend because from then on, the Geneveses were the gold standard and they still are. So, you know, an interesting guy, Vito Genovese, a guy that was hungry for power and ultimately got it, if just for a couple of years. As always, I thank you all for listening. And I'll tell you, I continue every day, every week, every time we do this show, I'm fascinated and so proud of the job we've been able to do on this show. I'm blown away every single time. I know I talk about it so much, but I really am blown away at it. I think we do such great work here. I know we can't make everybody happy. You know, occasionally we'll get a name wrong or something like that, but you know, we really enjoy this stuff and we feel like we've found something here. People like it. We're getting cool interviews. And this is just the beginning, guys. I've got a lot behind the scenes that I'm doing, that I've been working on, that I'm going to continue to put out there. And I thank you for being here every week. If you're new around here, you're just finding us, welcome. Hope you enjoy the show. Please make sure you give us 5 stars and give us a nice review if you enjoy what we're doing. As I said, go check us out on Twitter at the Sitdown 7 for sit down news and stuff about the show. And if you want more mob content, you know, smaller videos and things like that, make sure you go check us out on YouTube. Just search the Sitdown, a Mafia History podcast. Blackjack Fletcher should be back next week. We'll do another great mob topic. I think we're going to do Vincent Basciano. That'll be a good one. The Bonanno crime family. We'll go from kind of the 20s to the 60s to kind of present day. We'll talk a little bit about Vincent Basciano. And I think we're going to do an interview at some point, another interview. I've got a guy coming on that I think you guys will be interested in. I put a poll out on Twitter about, do you guys want to hear from an informant and a guy that was very much around people? Many people haven't heard from this guy. We did an interview and I've been sitting on it and I'm going to put it out. So that's something to expect down the road. Pretty interesting guy. And I think he has a pretty interesting story. So thank you for listening. As always, I am Jeff Nadeau. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.